Hi, Paul. Welcome to the Big Unlock podcast. It's really nice to have you here today with us.
Rohit, thank you so much for the invitation. It's a pleasure to be here.
Likewise. And Paul, we'll do some quick intros from our side very soon for the audience, then dive deep into the topic at hand. And I'm super excited to learn more about your research with AI and Gen AI. And of course, you know, any other things that you would like to bring out in this conversation. So I'm Rohit Mahajan. I'm the managing partner and CEO at BigRio and Demo Consulting. And over to you, Paul.
Fantastic. Well, Rohit, thank you again for the invitation. Really appreciate it. My name is Paul Yi. I'm an associate member, which would be the equivalent of an associate professor at most institutions, but that's just what we call it at St. Jude Children's Research Hospital in the Department of Radiology. I'm a body radiologist, as well as the section chief of Intelligent Imaging Informatics, which is our AI and informatics group in the department. In that role, I lead teams across the spectrum from, let's say, code to clinic. This comprises imaging IT, teams that apply AI to things like standardized tumor assessment responses, as well as core biomedical informatics research. I'm also a clinician scientist, and my lab studies two pillars, again, from code to clinic, asking questions about how do we use these technologies from the computer science world in safe and trustworthy ways for medicine? And then how do we take those lessons that we've learned and apply them to clinical problems? And specifically at St. Jude, what we focus on is pediatric cancer and other catastrophic diseases. And so my background, again, is I'm a medical doctor, but I've worked at this intersection of computer science for the past 8 years or so. This started during my training in radiology at Johns Hopkins, where I had some really amazing early experiences where, believe it or not, an ophthalmologist showed me what deep learning was, what AI was, when I was a second year resident. I was initially pretty skeptical, to tell you the truth. But once I saw what this was doing in our fields for, you know, Facebook with tagging our faces and Tesla with self-driving cars, yeah. You know, I had a hunch that this was really going to make a huge impact in radiology and medicine. And so that's where I got my start. And working with engineers at Johns Hopkins in my early years, to getting more involved with societies like the Radiological Society of North America, also known as RSNA, to doing an imaging informatics fellowship at the University of Maryland and working with pioneers like Dr. Elliot Siegel, who built the first digital radiology department in the world back in the 90s. If you can imagine, digital radiology, it hasn't been around that long. It's just been a wild ride and it's been a whole lot of fun. And now here I am at St. Jude. I've been here for a little less than a year. And I got to tell you, it's been an amazing place. Our mission is finding cures and saving children. And so I couldn't be more excited to be here and talking with you.
That's awesome, Paul. So may I know where you are based at?
Yeah, so I'm at St. Jude Children's Research Hospital. This is a hospital in Memphis, Tennessee. And this is a pretty unique place for a number of reasons. The first thing is we are the only National Cancer Institute designated cancer center that focuses exclusively on pediatric cancer. We're a top 10 pediatric cancer hospital. But the other unique part is if you look at our name, we're not St. Jude Hospital. We're not St. Jude Children's Hospital, but we're St. Jude Children's Research Hospital. Yeah. And since our founding in 1962, the whole purpose was to exist for clinical trials, to advance the science of how we treat pediatric cancer. And so everything we do centers around advancing knowledge and sharing that knowledge with the world. Just to put it in the perspective, when St. Jude was founded back in 1962, the survival rate for acute lymphoblastic leukemia, or ALL, it's the most common cancer in children, it was in the single digits. Wow. Fast forward, and with some of the first major developments, and some people would argue the first cures developed at St. Jude, that survival rate now in the US is over 90%. And wow, so we think about how far we've come, it's been tremendous. So that's where I'm based. If you can't tell, it's an incredibly mission-driven place. We focus, again, on pediatric cancer, but also other catastrophic diseases. These are life-threatening diseases, things like sickle cell disease, other hematologic disorders, pediatric neuromuscular diseases like spinal muscular atrophy. So it's just a really interesting place with a lot of really smart people working on really important problems for children. And radiology is no exception. And we've got a lot of really exciting things going on. And we'd love to talk to you more about it.
Yeah, that's awesome. I was actually getting to that. So tell us more about your work. And of course, you know, as you talk about, you know, what you're researching and using all these new technologies, please share with us any use cases on AI that you're exploring and how that could impact the pediatric patients and the kids.
Yeah, well, where can I start? I would say, in short, I think AI can touch every aspect of the patient's journey. And I think by extension, every aspect of a physician or other clinician's workflow and every member of the, let's say, allied health team. And when I say that because, you know, I got into AI not as an engineer. I don't have a formal engineering background, but I came into it from a clinical research perspective. I cut my teeth in research and maybe more traditional types of clinical research, like randomized controlled trials and retrospective chart reviews. And so I always looked at AI as this tool. It's a tool, just like any other. It can be used in many different ways. It can be used in many different situations. And I think that applies to radiology for sure. If we think about it, let's just use the radiology life cycle as an example. What happens before a patient gets imaged? Well, they've got to get scheduled. Their physician needs to put in an order. And then what happens is a radiologist will actually review that order and make a protocol. These are all steps of the process that might seem pretty straightforward, but are fraught with a lot of pitfalls and maybe some processing delays. So for instance, the protocoling, it might seem straightforward. Hey, get an MRI of the abdomen and pelvis. We need to evaluate for cancer. But depending on the type of cancer you have, and depending on the types of treatments that a child has had and maybe their prior surgery history, what we prescribe as radiologists can be very different. For instance, the type of contrast we give, there's two types broadly. One is a general contrast and the other is something called EOVIS, which is a very liver specific contrast. We have to dig into what type of cancer was it. We have to talk about how much of the abdomen do we image? Is it just the upper part? Is it the entire abdomen going into the pelvis? What types of sequences do we use? So there's a lot of information that needs to be processed that requires a lot of very specific knowledge. So you can imagine that a radiologist, we're not just sitting there reading studies. We have to take time to protocol these studies. So that's one use case where AI can help automatically protocoling these studies. Maybe taking the knowledge that we as radiologists may have amassed over years, distilling it down into an algorithm that can then say, here's the order, here's the patient's chart in the EMR. Now I'm going to make a decision and then the radiologist can approve it. Or perhaps in some cases, it can work autonomously. But that's just one example, even before we get to imaging. If we take a fast forward to imaging, there's just so many steps that go into it as well that AI can have a role in. One of them is image reconstruction. How do we make images look better? A lot of times we might get an MRI or CT, but there are certain artifacts, whether it be just noise in the images or if the patient moves, that can make the images look blurry. So what researchers as well as vendors are now releasing are AI algorithms that can take images that are suboptimal quality and make them look better and what we call diagnostic quality, meaning it's more similar to what we would expect as the best possible outcome. And then, again, the possibilities are endless, but I'll leave you with a more patient-facing kind of use case. Radiologists, we don't have as much patient interaction as maybe an oncologist or a neurologist, but we still do get some FaceTime. We often get questions about our radiology reports, especially now in today's day and age when patients often see their reports before they get to talk to their doctor. One of the use cases that I think is most compelling from a patient-facing perspective in radiology is how can we translate these reports from medical jargon to a piece of, you know, often dense and complex with good reason words into a format that'll be more understandable to a patient and maybe their parents to, you know, whether they're a child, whether they're the parent. And so that's just a few examples of how I think AI can really play a big role in radiology. But again, the possibilities are endless. And that's one thing I would encourage anyone. Even if you're not interested in AI and research, I think if you have a clinical need or if there's some, let's say, process need, there's a way that AI can probably be used to make things more efficient, quicker, and potentially more accurate.
Yeah, I think you're just pointing in the right direction, Paul, because the ChatGPT and, you know, the whole democratization of AI, it's accessible to everyone. All of us use it in our daily lives in one form or another and in our functional areas as well. So what you said about the translating the dense report, which is, let's say, more clinician oriented to patient oriented, is such a fine use case for this technology, because not only it can, I think, do that at scale, but it can also do that in many languages automatically.
Oh, totally.
Yeah. So that's a great point. So tell us a little bit about EMR EHR seems to be a centerpiece of patient records and every hospital system. So do you have a separate research-oriented database and a whole entire system for that? Or are you plugged into the EMR EHR, and how do you leverage data across? You mentioned that data is key and it always is top of your mind. So talk with us about your data strategy and the integration and the interoperability piece of it.
Yeah, well, to answer your first question, we do have a clinical EMR, and these are often, believe it or not, used for certain research purposes. For instance, if you're recruiting a patient for a clinical trial, because clinical trials are really at the heart of what we do at St. Jude, there are separate patient lists that can keep track of who's on which trial. Are they in this arm or that arm? Maybe not that last part, but definitely in what trial they're on. And that's important for a number of reasons. I think that there are a lot of, as you know, in clinical trials, there's going to be a lot of inclusion, exclusion criteria, certain things that patients can and cannot be, let's say, exposed to, whether that's a certain type of treatment or a certain type of medication. In addition to that, there are other databases that we use clinically, like our PACS, which is the Picture Archival Communication System. This is the system that I use as a radiologist on a regular basis to view images, to interpret them. And again, there are some limited research capabilities that we can use it for. But by and large, for research, what we have to do is create these separate databases in some form or fashion and use different, let's say, softwares or data processing pipelines. And so my strategy around that is really first doing a landscape mapping. What are our sources of data? And we can think of them as primary sources if we think about how we think about journalism or if we think about history. Primary sources are straight from the source. It might be the EMR. It might be the PACS. It might be a legacy PACS, because I will say that we have changed systems over the years. We've changed EMRs. So oftentimes when you go back historically, data that you assume is in one place actually predates it in another system. So I think once you figure that out, what we're doing is we're extracting that data and perhaps making a secondary form of it, where we say, okay, we've taken it from all of these different places, maybe the pre-2010 EHR and then the post-2010 EHR. We bring them together. And then I would say the hard part happens, which is how do we process and refine this data? If we think of data, we often call it a gold mine. I think that's one part of the puzzle, but what do you have to do with gold? You've got to refine it. You've got to process it. And I'll say that this is very different for every type of data. Text data is going to be very different from tabular data, which is going to be very different from imaging data. And so a big strategy for me is we put people in their strength zones. In my department, in my section of intelligent imaging informatics, we are bona fide experts in medical imaging, all the way from clinical aspects to the medical physics, all the way down to the core imaging IT. So that's really where the bulk of our efforts are, because we know the imaging best. We work with it on a daily basis. On that same token, though, we need to connect the imaging with the EHR. So we are developing strategies to have access to EHR data, to process them, but also link in those experts who work with the EHR on a more regular primary basis. And at St. Jude, I'm really blessed to have colleagues who have these complementary expertises in the clinical informatics team outside of radiology, within the Office of Data Science, within all of these different areas and within pathology. And the idea for me is, again, we place people in their strength zones so that, one, we can make the best use of our skill set. In radiology, we often talk about AI helping us operate at the top of our license or the top of our skill set. I think it's the same thing here. This might not be AI, but I think it is real intelligence that I as a radiologist have, that my colleagues in pathology have in their domain, that my colleagues on the clinical informatics side have on the EHR. And so bringing that together, my vision is that we create these separate databases that are highly specialized for that data, but they're all interoperable. And so one of the key things here is that although we build things out perhaps separately to focus in on our strength areas, they all have to follow a unified vision. And so one simple case is medical record numbers. I will say that sometimes you have a medical record number that might be listed in one format in, let's say, the PACS. But when you go to the EHR, it might not translate. And that might simply be because, hey, you need to add three zeros in front of that medical record number. And the idea is that, again, these systems, they all have their own idiosyncrasies and their own requirements. It's kind of like when we make a password, they say, hey, you need 10 to 15 characters. It might just be that one system says, I need 10 characters. And if you don't have 10, just put zeros. And the other might say, you can give me 7. But when you try to harmonize them together, there's something's lost in translation. So these are just some of the, bumps in the road that are just natural and part of it. But again, I think this is what makes it honestly kind of fun and interesting. You know, if it was so turnkey, if it was just super easy, you know, on one hand, that would be nice. But on the other hand, I think that that's what makes this whole process rewarding and fun. We identify these challenges, we overcome them. And I think that strengthens the team dynamics. It strengthens our ability to understand these perhaps smaller problems. So then when the big problems come, we're also ready to tackle those. So that's at a pretty high level.
Yeah.
But I think the big key message is synergy. It's interdisciplinary collaboration in understanding what are we good at? What are we not good at? And then how do we bring those together? So we really have the sum greater than the whole of its parts.
And then on the newer technologies side, Paul, we've seen generative AI being used extensively now. And you were earlier talking about a project that you're also part of. So would you like to talk a little bit more about applications of generative AI?
Absolutely. I think generative AI is one of the most incredible and exciting technologies that have certainly come in my lifetime. And I would imagine for a long time ahead. I'll give you just a couple examples. One that is a little bit more research focused, and then another, which is perhaps more patient focused. The more research focused is this idea of virtual imaging trials. And this is a collaboration with one of my colleagues, Matthias Umberoff, who's a computer science professor at Johns Hopkins. And the idea is that for medical imaging, the way that things have historically worked when we evaluate new imaging strategies is we say, hey, we're going to have two groups of patients. We're going to image them in two different ways. Let's say lung cancer screening. And this was done in something called the NLST, which was the National Lung Screening Trial back over a decade ago. And what they did is they randomized patients to CT scans or x-rays and said, which one is better for lung cancer screening? And it turned out CT scans are better. And that's great because every patient from here on out who's getting screened for lung cancer will get a CT scan. But it wasn't so good for the patients who didn't get that CT scan during the trial, because unfortunately, some of those patients did have cancer that might not have been caught, and some of them may have even passed away. So the idea with a virtual imaging trial is, hey, if we wanted to run this trial again, maybe we can take patient data that we have, let's say CT scans, let's say chest x-rays. We can train a generative AI model that's learned all of the different features, all of the different appearances based on demographics, based on disease status, based on the part of the country that they live in. And we can create these different versions of images. Maybe we can say, this is what a patient who had this age and this sex and from this part of the country with these types of exposures, maybe to smoking, would look like if we created a chest x-ray. This is what their CT scan might have looked like if we had created a low-dose CT or a high-dose CT. And this is where it's really interesting, because generative AI, it's not just creating funny pictures like DALL-E and these other models, but we can incorporate medical physics type of knowledge into these models to say, hey, I want to tweak the CT scan and see what would happen if I use this type of CT scanner or this type of, let's say, voltage or physics parameter. Mm-hmm. And the idea is that we can create an almost infinite number of samples. Mm-hmm. And so this collaboration, we took whole body CT scans and we trained an AI model that could generate, again, virtual populations where we could say, I want this percentage of males, this percentage of females. Mm-hmm. I want this number of patients who are less than 65 years old and this number greater than 65 years old. And the way we validated it is we asked, number one, when we take an AI algorithm that can quantify the fat and the muscle, do we have the same distributions that we would expect from the real population? And lo and behold, we did. Wow. And then the second question is, do these images pass the sniff test? Are they actually representing patient anatomy correctly? And when we looked at various quantitative measures, they seem to look very similar to real images. So this is very, I would say, cutting edge. It's very research heavy. But I do believe this is one of the futures where we can create these virtual patient populations and maybe one day be able to do these clinical trials that historically have taken many years and many sites and millions of dollars of funding, and perhaps do them in silico, if you will, in the lab on the computer. So that's something that I'm very excited about. I think it's just one example. So that's one example that's very research heavy. The more patient-facing example, I'll tell you, is some of the work we've done evaluating ChatGPT and asking, hey, we know that everyone's using ChatGPT, whether it's me as an AI researcher or my mother who might just have questions about her healthcare. So we've put it through its paces and asked, when we ask common questions about, let's say, lung cancer screening or breast cancer screening, how accurate are these responses? Number one. Number two, how readable are they? And three, do they sometimes give false information? And what we found is most of the time, they're actually pretty good. They give answers that are quite accurate. They do give answers that are a little bit wordy sometimes. So the readability is a little bit higher than one might expect. Mm-hmm. That might be related to the fact that doctors are often the ones writing these educational materials. So that's what the AI has learned from. But the more concerning part is that although it's good most of the time, it's a non-trivial amount of time where it's wrong. And the challenge is when you read the responses, it sounds very confident. It sounds very authoritative. Yeah. And it's often hard to check it, right? Because if you could fact check this, why would you be using it in the first place, especially if you're a patient and not necessarily a physician? Yeah. And so to me, these works are illuminating because it shows us the potential, right? This technology is amazing. I mean, you have like this chatbot, it can search the internet, it can do math calculations with some caveats. Some people have some issues with that, but it can certainly find information about things like cancer. But I think the big question is, how do we trust it? How do we know when it doesn't know what it's talking about? We often use this term in medicine, or this phrase that, you know, doctors are often wrong, never in doubt. And that's a little bit of a cheeky way to say that sometimes, you know, you don't know what you don't know. And I think that it's the same case for these chatbots. And so there's a lot of work being done on the computer science side about how do we know when these generative AI large language models, when they're uncertain, how do we build in these safety check marks? And that's really a large part of my work is how do we take those insights and those methods from computer science and then translate them into medicine? Because I'll say for our listeners, one thing that served me well in my career and I use as a cornerstone of anything that I do is being able to speak the languages of the technical side, of the clinical side, and translate. Because if you can imagine, the way that a physician might describe a problem is totally different from how a computer scientist might conceptualize it. So that's just one example from the patient-facing side.
That's great to know, Paul. So I think we are coming towards the last few minutes in this podcast. I would like to definitely touch upon one more topic and then back to you for closing remarks as well. Very wide open on that. So, but my curious question is that you're in research and there's a real world out there, which is the industry and the startups. So how do you think about the bridge from research to commercialization, and how do you embrace innovation with the startups as well?
Yeah, that is a tremendous question because it's something that I think often people, they're a little afraid to ask. I think in academia, people often have this like purist mentality, like we're here to do research. Yeah. And then industry often is looked at, oh, well, that's the other side. But I'm a firm believer that the real way to take technologies that might be developed in academia and have it impact the patient is through commercialization. One reason why I got into research was I felt like for every hour I spend on research, it's an opportunity to touch the lives of countless patients beyond my time. When I do my clinical work, I can help a patient one at a time, but the research, you can help them far beyond the borders of your own state or your country or even your time. I think it's the same thing with commercialization. You know, I might be able to produce an algorithm that works really well in the lab. It might publish a paper that is really groundbreaking, but that's a far cry from bringing it out into something that's clinically ready. One example of this is, hey, you might have the best performing AI. It might have 100% accuracy and sensitivity and specificity for a type of cancer, but that's just computer code. You need to build a user interface for a physician to use. You need to build out a system where you can plug into an IT system in a hospital. And these are all things that I think do have research components, but it's really something that is best served, in my opinion, in industry. How do we scale these things? How do we make it tailored for the user? As far as how we do that, I think that it's easier said than done. I think that, you know, my biggest observation is that when people from academia and people from industry, whether it's large established companies or startups, they're often speaking different languages. Again, the importance of translating, as well as not really understanding what each person's incentive is or each group's incentives are. I do think that there is a way to align these things, but I think it's important to realize it's got to be a give and take kind of thing. One example I'll tell you is I think startups often come to me, to colleagues around the country, and they say, hey, we'd love to collaborate with you. we'll give you free access to our software, but what we want is feedback and we want to help improve this. And to tell you the truth, I think that might sound good if you're coming at it from the startup perspective. But for me, on the academic side, both as a researcher, as well as holding a leadership position in my department, what's going through my head is, well, that's fantastic. But number one, if I didn't need this software in the first place, I don't really have a compelling desire to implement this. Because two, I need personnel and human effort to implement this, to evaluate it. I need time administratively to even come up with a plan to adequately evaluate it. And so I think that while that may seem like it's meeting our incentives, oftentimes I would, you know, advise startups and companies that that's part of the puzzle, perhaps. But I think the other part is thinking about, well, what's the other hidden costs here? And I would kind of encapsulate that as sweat equity. Sweat equity can certainly be free, but it could also be accounted for in these collaborations. So that's just one example. I think there are many others I could go through, but I would say the biggest thing is understand what each person's incentive is and try to align them together.
That's fantastic. That's fantastic, Paul. Thank you so much. So any other thoughts from your side, about St. Jude's or your work that you would like to share with the audience or any other kind of like you are looking at the future, let's say 1 to 3 years from now, any trends or directions that you can spot either in radiology or any other field that you are, close with?
Definitely. I'll just end with this. I think that the future is incredibly bright. I think what we have done in AI for the past 8-10 years or so is just scratching the tip of the iceberg. I can speak to you about my field in radiology. Technically, we have generally lagged about 5 years behind the state of the art in computer science. So I felt like even though we were answering clinically important questions, a lot of what we were doing, we weren't really reaching our potential. I think that gap is narrowing, where we're having much more communication and collaboration between computer scientists who know what the latest and greatest technology is, along with the clinical experts. So that gap is narrowing. So I think just from a pure potential standpoint, we're going to see a lot more rapid translation of these technologies into medicine. But I think the second piece is looking beyond the borders of, let's say, my specialty. I think the future is multimodal data integration. We're seeing it now with ChatGPT extending beyond text. Now it can process audio, it can process video, it can process imaging. I think in that same way, when you think about how a patient is taken care of, it's not just imaging alone. It's not just text alone or vital signs. It's really a doctor synthesizing it all together. And to me, that's where the future is. These multimodal large models that can integrate the medical imaging, that can integrate the vital signs, the laboratory values, the free text, and give a comprehensive picture of a patient's health. And I think that's going to be one of the keys, frankly, for solving these unanswered questions in pediatric cancer and other catastrophic diseases. You know, I want to say that that work is alive and well here at St. Jude. We're actively working on it, both in our individual departments as well as at an institutional level. And I just want to give a shout out to the institution. You know, our mission is finding cures and saving children. Yeah, it's just been a tremendous thing to be a part of. And I'm excited for the future of what we're going to do at our institution. But I think more broadly, through collaborations that we might be a part of, but also just seeing what the world does as a community. There's just so many interesting things going on, whether it's in the United States or outside. So it's going to be super cool to see how the technology rubber meets the road, if you will, and how it really makes an impact in our clinical work.
Absolutely. Very, very exciting times. And I'm looking forward to staying in touch with you, Paul, comparing notes into the future, and then perhaps having you back again on our podcast.
Absolutely. I would love that. Thank you so much for having me.